This is your weekly checkup with Howard Feldman and Dr. Anton Myberg, where medical innovation meets human understanding.
It is 5 minutes past the hour of six. I'm Howard Feldman. Tonight on the weekly checkup, we're tackling something that affects almost everyone, but that many people still don't fully understand, and that is mental health. We all know what stress feels like, but when does normal stress become anxiety? When does burnout become something more serious? And when is your body actually trying to tell you that something isn't right? Because mental health isn't always obvious. It doesn't always look dramatic. Sometimes it manifests in poor sleep, low energy, irritability, and a sense that things just aren't quite right. And then there's the part that people often missed. Sometimes what looks like mental health issues is actually something medical. Maybe it's thyroid problems, sleep disorders, neurological conditions, and even epilepsy. Tonight, Dr. Anton Myberg and I are going to unpack the full picture. What is normal? What is not? What to watch for? And most importantly, when to act. Dr. Anton Myberg, good evening. How are you?
Good evening. Good and you? I think we've got a tough subject to discuss tonight.
It actually is a very tough subject because we also, you know, part of my concern around the subject is we live in very dramatic times. So people aren't just a little stressed, they're suffering anxiety. They have PTSD, and many of us, many people do, but we really live in the world of hyperbole, so it's quite difficult to ascertain what is and what isn't. I mean, we use this term mental health very loosely. Is there a way, what does it mean medically?
So mental health is, we define it as a state of mental well-being that enables somebody to cope with stress of life, realize their abilities, learn and work productively and contribute to the community. It's a person's cognitive, their behavioral, and their emotional well-being, which represents a spectrum from their functioning well to experiencing severe illness. So it not only involves their brain chemistry, it also involves genetic factors, their experiences in life. These are the things that affect an individual on how they feel, what they do, how they act, and how they manage stress and relate to other people. And if you look at the definition of mental illness, it's a diagnosable condition such as depression or anxiety or schizophrenia, bipolar, something that significantly interferes with a person's life, their daily functioning, or their ability to handle stress. And there's not only biological, there's also physical links to this. It's not something that's just in their mind, but it is deeply linked to their physical health and their brain biology. So their mental health conditions can manifest as physical symptoms, like you said earlier on, with chronic pain, headaches, or exhaustion. But you've got to look at the major components of what it involves. And it involves emotional well-being, psychological functioning, and social functioning. And the emotional well-being is managing emotions effectively. Psychologically, it's thinking clearly and rationally. And socially, it's maintaining healthy relationships and interacting positively with others.
We are going to go to ads, so we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, I want to try and understand what is the difference between normal emotional stress and a mental health disorder. If you have any questions on the subject at all, send me a WhatsApp on 061-895-1019. If you prefer, we will keep these questions anonymous. If you want me to specifically, if you are comfortable me repeating your name or reading out your name, then just sign it. But other than that, we are very, very happy to keep things anonymous because sometimes it is a subject that people have a little bit of discomfort about.
IFM 101.9 megahertz of life.
It is 10 minutes past the hour of 6. I'm Howard Feldman in a studio with Dr. Anton Myberg. It is your weekly checkup. We're talking mental health. We invite your questions and your comments on 061-895-1019. Anton, what is the difference between normal emotional stress and a mental health disorder?
So normal emotional stress is someone's reaction to a specific external trigger. It's temporary, it's reaction-based, responding to like an external pressure, for example, a deadline or an argument that generally tend to subside once the trigger passes. It's compared to a passing rain shower. It's uncomfortable, but you know it will end.
Right.
Whereas with regards to mental health, stress becomes a mental health concern when it's unrelenting or persists even without a clear trigger. And the analogy with the stress and the mental health stress is it's compared to an unrelenting storm or a dark cloud that follows you everywhere. So it's persistent, it's often overwhelming, it interferes with daily functioning, with your sleep, relationships, with things that indicate that you actually require professional help. And the differences in emotional stress and mental stress is the duration, intensity. As we said, normal stress is temporary, whereas mental stress is chronic and long-lasting. The causes and the impact on your functioning. And we know with normal stress, example, you're about to do a presentation. You feel anxious before that. That's stress. You're stressed about a deadline. But once that deadline is over, you're back to your normal feelings. With regards to a mental health stress, you have this persistent anxiety that stops you from, for example, leaving the house, or you have a debilitating depression or even uncontrollable panic attacks.
So is there I understand what you're saying around a deadline, and that makes sense. But what happens if somebody has an ongoing persistent stress about financial stress, worrying about.
Once it's ongoing, it becomes chronic, then yes. It becomes a mental. It's no longer an emotional stress.
So even though there is an external,
even though it's an external trigger, but if it's something that's chronic and you can't get rid of it,
right. In other words, somebody, God forbid, isn't well in the family.
Right.
If you can't get, and that's an
get
ongoing
that,
thing, but
that,
if you can't get
of
out
flow,
of,
yeah.
then it becomes a chronic thing.
It becomes a chronic thing. So you know, as we said, with normal emotional stress, once the trigger's removed, it's gone.
Right. Okay. So we're going to be talking about all of these things. How common are anxiety and depression globally and in South Africa?
So they are the most common mental health issues in the world, and they affect about 1 billion people globally.
Whoa.
So in South Africa, the prevalence rates are actually higher than the global averages. They say that 1 in 4 people in South Africa, which is about 25% of people, experience symptoms of depression. South Africa has one of the highest recorded rates of mental distress globally, and it ranks near the bottom of several mental state reports. And that includes general depression, which is about 25% of adults, anxiety, which is over 15% of adults. And they say there's about a 1 in 3 lifetime risk that a South African will suffer from a mental health condition at some point. And the reasons for this are there are vulnerable groups, your teens, your adolescents, your university students. You've got high risk factors for these people.
Well, you've got something like a 50 to 60% youth unemployment
yep,
rate.
So that's it. So it's linked to poverty, unemployment, adverse childhood experiences such as abuse or neglect. And then there's a big problem in this country. There's a treatment gap. So despite the high burden, only 1 in 10 South Africans with a mental illness has access to treatment. 1 in 10. So 90% of people who are living with mental illness in South Africa do not have any access to treatment. And the economic impact of that is that the South African economy loses 161 billion rand annually due to this.
Because people don't
not productive. People can't look for jobs. People don't function normally within their realms of functioning.
How genetic is this?
So there's definitely a genetic role towards this. It does link to certain family risks, but there's a high risk for things like bipolar disorder and that kind of condition with regards to depression, anxiety. Just because your mother was depressed doesn't mean you're going to be depressed. So we don't always find that in every family that depression is a genetic thing only. Obviously, there are genetic factors.
Right. Okay, got it. Why do so many people struggle to recognize when they need help?
So there's an old saying, cowboys don't cry. That's the stigma that's put onto mental health disease. People struggle because there's a combination of a deep-seated psychological and social and cultural factors that say that you have to be self-reliant, you have to be strong, and anything out of that realm is considered failure. So people then are reluctant to look for treatment or to be diagnosed with a mental health abnormality. So people are scared of being vulnerable, they're scared of being judged, because then they sort out as being weak or inadequate. People, especially in professional sides, they look for perfectionism and shame, and they get shamed if they are shown to have failed in something. There's internalized stigmas that people think that they don't deserve help. And obviously trauma and past experiences play a big role in this. And there's lots of myths in the whole social and cultural conditioning of people. You know, society often says that we must be rugged, we must be independent, you must praise people who pull themselves up and do it on their own.
But isn't there something in that? Like I always wonder, you know, and you think back to our grandparents and great-grandparents and the terribly difficult lives that they lived. Now, there was no space to focus on mental health. Does it mean they didn't actually, they were miserable, actually, now that I come to think of it.
Well, they did suffer. I mean, they went through their own trauma and their own...
Real trauma.
Not that our trauma is not real.
But that's what I'm trying to understand. Is there a danger in being too accepting of anxiety? Does it lead to a lack of resilience, for example?
So I think you've got to put yourselves in the shoes of somebody who suffers from chronic anxiety or chronic stress.
Right.
If you ignore that, you're writing the person off for the rest of their life, because they will never build confidence. They'll never be able to do things. Obviously, you know, as a parent, when you bring up your own children, you want your children to be successful. And as a parent, we all make mistakes, but you sometimes push your children, say, like, man up, you'll be okay, do things like that. And that's okay once in a while, but not as a rule. As a rule, you've got to be there to encourage and listen and communicate with them so you can understand if they've got issues and problems, not as our previous generation of grandparents used to just ignore things, move along,
and in fact,
get things done.
They never even spoke about, many of them actually had difficulty speaking about the traumas that they lived through.
Yeah, but that was due to a lack of insight. I mean, they denied the fact that stress and anxiety was something real. You know, depression or burnout, you know, that's not okay in those days. And even so, in the last number of years, it's become a reality of people. People are depressed. They're burnt out. There's economic barriers. There's overwhelming social media that affects people. There's, you know, being consistently barraged by newsreels and all these things. And our children being 24 hours a day on social media and seeing all these things. These are different stresses that lead to different types of reality. And I think from COVID, personally, we saw that our children suffered dramatically during the COVID stages when they weren't able to interact socially, when they weren't at school, when they were on Zoom. They suffered dramatically.
We're going to take a break. Before we do that, I'm interested to hear from you. 061-895-1019. What mental health issue do you think affects people the most today? Is it stress, anxiety, burnout, depression, or loneliness? What do you think? Help me out here. 061-895-1019. I'm Howard Feldman in conversation with Dr. Anton Meiberg. We're talking mental health. We'll be back just after this.
Hi FM, your station of choice since 2008.
It is 6:21. I'm Howard Feldman in conversation with Dr. Anton Meiberg. We're talking about mental health, and I want to focus now on anxiety and panic disorders. So, send your question, 061-895-1019. And everybody says that they have anxiety today. I'm interested in what qualifies as an anxiety disorder.
So in order to qualify that as a disorder, it's a mental health condition which includes excessive, persistent, and unreasonable fear or worry that interferes with your daily life. It's lasting at least 6 months. And unlike normal stress, these disorders cause uncontrollable or irrational anxiety about everyday situations. They can manifest with physical symptoms like racing heart, muscle tension, fatigue, And we get different types of anxiety disorders, a generalized anxiety disorder, which is about everyday life, a panic disorder, which is a sudden intense terror leading to physical symptoms. People have social anxiety disorder, agoraphobia, phobias, whether they're intense or irrational fears of specific objects. And people are scared of clowns. People are scared of
dead pigeons.
Oh, I think most people are scared of those.
Oh, okay,
separation anxiety that children go through. And symptoms are emotional. There's constant worry. There's dread. There's irritability. There's physical symptoms of pounding heart, palpitations. And then it lands up causing behavioral problems because you avoid situations. You don't want to be in them, any situation that causes anxiety, so you tend to move away from that type of situation.
Excuse me. Sorry about that. It wasn't anxiety. It was just something. Anyway, what I find interesting is that many of us, we all function at different levels of stress and anxiety. I find that I do my best work when I am at a higher level of stress and anxiety. So maybe that's a 6 out of 10.
But why is it? Because your cortisol levels flare up. You're in a fight and flight situation. So some people do benefit from being in that sort of short period of time.
Right. But if my baseline is 6, let's say, somebody else's could be 3. Is
6, 7.
Can we not do that? Can we not? I mean, I don't know. We were sounding sensible for a change. Does that mean that somebody else that goes from a 3 to a 6 actually now is suffering anxiety, whereas I function at a 6, that's fine. It's only if I go to an 8 that there's
a concern. So that's interesting that you raise it, because I always say to my asthmatic patients, you've come to see me, you didn't know you had asthma. You think your breathing is okay, but once you start on the medication, within the next 4 weeks, you will breathe like you've never breathed before, and you'll realize how bad you're breathing during that time. And it's the same thing with that. Just because you think your function is a 6 doesn't mean that it's okay or it's normal. Mm. So someone who's functioning at a 3 and goes to a 6, you can't equate your function with somebody else's functioning, because there's a whole cognitive, behavioral, emotional upset that's going on in that person's life.
Okay, so that is that's a very, very, it's very interesting. And again, give me your thoughts on that, because I'm fascinated by how we all function with this. What are the physical symptoms of anxiety? You said increased heart rate.
So a lot of the time they can be mistaken for serious life-threatening disorders or chronic illnesses, because once again, as I said, your body's in a fight or flight response,
right?
And that causes tangible physical reactions. So you can get chest pain, you get a racing heart, you can get difficulties in breathing, you can get gastrointestinal distress. And the most common things are, when people have anxiety, especially these panic attacks, it can mimic a heart attack. So people think they're having a heart attack, they go to the emergency room. Or you get hyperventilation. So you get anxiety, you hyperventilate, you get rapid, shallow breathing, and people think they've got a feeling of air hunger, they think they're having an asthma attack, or they think they're having an exacerbation of their COPD. Even neurological disorders, with persistent anxiety, you get this tingling, or this lightheadedness, this pins and needles, this trembling and shaking. And these symptoms are often often due to hyperventilation, actually, because when you're hyperventilating, you lower your carbon dioxide levels in your blood, rather than having an actual neurological deficit.
Right.
And we all hear about the stomach issues. We've spoken about irritable bowel syndrome and that's your gut-brain connection. And anxiety actually can halt your digestion or cause intense discomfort. You get chronic pain. You get muscle aches, which, when your body is bracing itself for danger, it leads to a chronic muscle pain. You get very common tension headaches, feeling like you've got a tight band around your head, TMJ, neck pain, muscle spasms. So there's a large collection of symptoms that can present with this type of thing. And you need to know how to differentiate these. So when you differentiate them, if you've got severe chest pain and it radiates to your jaw or down your left arm, get to an emergency room. If you faint or lose consciousness, get to an emergency room. If you've got sudden weakness or numbness on one side of the body only, get to emergency room. The worst that can happen to you is they say to you, it's a panic attack or something like that.
It's been embarrassing.
And not anymore.
Isn't it?
No, not in 2026. It was in 2024.
I think I'd rather have a heart attack than a panic attack. Because just if you land up at the hospital, I'm saying. No. Is that not normal?
I think it's time for an ad break.
No, I'm just saying. I think I can't wait.
See, that's the point. There's a stigma on mental health. So people are so scared. An example I use for my patients is if you fracture your hip, yes. you're going to walk with a crutch. You are, because you need the crutch to help you walk.
Yes.
But God forbid we say to somebody, you've got a mental health disorder, take medication for it. There's such a stigma around this, and people are so nervous of being told that they've got a mental health deficit. Tell someone they've got diabetes, no problem. Tell someone they've got asthma, no problem. Tell someone you've got depression, or you're seeing a psychologist for depression, and your whole world crumbles.
Wow. That's amazing. Look, I do think some of it's in the language. A panic attack does sound a bit girly.
So I think you've got to understand what a panic attack is.
Yes.
And a panic attack is different to anxiety because it's a sudden episode of intense fear.
Okay.
And it triggers a severe physical reaction. You get that racing heart as well, chest pain, shortness of breath,
mm-hmm.
but there's no real immediate danger. And they're terrifying because here, once again, your body's fight and flight system causes false sensations. You feel like you're dying, like you're losing control or having a heart attack. And you get these intense physical symptoms, which are misinterpreted by the brain as life-threatening.
Wow.
So you lose control, you feel like you're not in a safe environment, and you get an unwarranted rush of adrenaline and cortisol in the body that can even cause a choking sensation. It causes cognitive distortions. You experience an overwhelming sense of impending doom or fear of going crazy. There's a mental detachment. There's so many different things that happen
terrible.
Because of that.
Right. I remember being told that when our kids were young and one of them or all of them, I can't remember, had anxiety, that anxiety could be, if not treated, could be a precursor to depression. I don't know if it's still the thinking or if it's a completely separate type of thing, because so we're going to move on to talk about depression.
I think
depression.
That's important because, you know, prior to COVID, you know, as a medical professional, I used to diss anxiety. You know, that was our training. We're very scientific. So we taught not to take sort of cognizance of these things. Yes, the person's anxious, move on, do these type of things.
Everyone's anxious, get over it.
Having gone through COVID and having had PTSD from COVID and developing an element of depression, anxiety from it, which are actually co-linked, it's very much easier to understand what people are going through.
Right.
You have to go through a burden in your own life to realize what it's about. So if I hadn't gone through COVID and I hadn't had PTSD and I had all the issues I had from COVID without realizing that I had them until it was an issue for me, I wouldn't have understood what it actually means to be anxious and what it means to be depressed.
Right.
You know, when you're losing 8 patients a day within an hour, you end up becoming depressed, not only anxious.
Right. So it does. It is actually.
It definitely can add to that.
Yeah. I want to ask you when I had a couple of armed robberies and I was suffering from PTSD. And I remember at one stage feeling almost like this hot wave that flowed through my body. And I was seeing somebody at that stage to help me with my PTSD. And they said, it was brilliant advice. Don't fight it. It's going to happen. So don't fight it. Just know and let it kind of wash over you. And when I was started to be able to do that, it happened a couple of times and then never again because I stopped fighting it.
Okay, but look at us. I mean, here we are in 2026 telling people that we've had anxiety, PTSD, depression.
Mm.
If we had done this 5 years ago, the radio would have been switched off and, you know, we wouldn't have been able to put our heads up without being in shame.
It's true.
This is the reality. We're all living with this, you know.
And that is absolutely true. 061-895-1019. Let me have your questions. Let me have your experience. Have you suffered from some form of PTSD? How are you dealing with it? And it was interesting that, in fact, a little bit early on, Simon showed this. This was one of the conversations that they were having. But obviously, as it relates to war, and we are going to be talking about that. A little bit later, we are going to come back to that. Let's talk about depression and burnout. What separates, firstly, sadness from a clinical depression?
Sure, yeah. So sadness is temporary. Sadness is a normal emotional reaction to disappointment or to loss, and that passes with time.
Okay.
But clinical depression is a persistent mental health condition which lasts for at least 2 weeks, and it's characterized by a big word called anhedonia, which is a loss of interest.
Okay.
You get profound hopelessness, there are physical symptoms, and it impairs your daily life. The duration of depression is ongoing, lasting for weeks, versus sadness, which is temporary.
Right.
Depression often makes it impossible for people to get out of bed, to go to school, or to be involved in social activities. And because you lose that pleasure in life, almost all of your activities just feel like it's typical simple sadness, where it's more than that. You get physical symptoms which are attributed to depression and not to sadness, because you get fatigue and weight changes and sleeping difficulties, and your self-worth with depression goes down. You get extreme guilt. A lot of people can get suicidal thoughts. So in essence, sadness is a feeling, but clinical depression is a disease. And that often requires professional help, that people need help with that type of thing.
Do you think that part of the reason that we are having a crisis that we are is maybe because we aren't using the words that we should? That maybe when we're talking to our kids, it's different to say you're feeling sad.
Well, what's the worst word in the entire English dictionary? Fine. How are you feeling?
Fine.
I'm fine. I'm okay. When someone says
flat.
I'm fine, I'm okay,
flat.
You know that they're not fine and okay.
Yeah.
Because they don't know how to express or that they need to express an emotion. None of us grew up, or none of us elderly people over the ages of 45, and I say elderly, grew up with the constant idea that it's okay to not be okay, and there's help to help you on that journey.
Yeah. Yeah, it's amazing that the impact that it had, and using the right words, it really
use your words, Howard.
Yeah, that's what I need to start doing. I need to start using my words. Okay, so what are the symptoms in terms of depression? What are the symptoms that we sometimes might miss?
So sometimes people misunderstand depression as just a feeling sad disease.
Right.
But it actually presents with other behavioral, physical, and cognitive changes that are overlooked, and we attribute them to other diseases or other causes. People miss the fact that there's increased irritability or is increased anger. And this is especially in men. You know, when men become very angry or irritable or have got a short fuse, or they complain of, or even people generally, unexplained physical pain, backache, headache, severe fatigue that doesn't improve with rest. These are the symptoms that get missed. And the irritability and the anger, which is instead of sadness, you know, you find there's smiling or what you call a hidden depression, because people force their happiness. They force the fact that they appear productive and cheerful in public while they hide their feelings of worthlessness. A lot of people, unfortunately, become alcoholics.
Or high-functioning professionals who are able to hide it.
I mean, you get people who hide their alcohol or substance abuse. They turn to alcohol and drugs to medicate themselves to mask these feelings.
Yeah.
And then the other people that get involved in reckless behavior. They do risky activities,
Twitter.
Reckless driving.
Oh. Is Twitter one of these?
Isn't it called X? I'm just saying.
Oh, X, yes.
Gambling, dangerous sports. And one of the biggest symptoms that people miss is the withdrawal from social life. People, there's an obvious gradual and subtle withdrawal from their hobbies and their friends, and it can be just brushed off as, no, they're busy or they need downtime. And we can go through all of these things. There's sleep disturbances from a physical point of view.
Mm.
You know, people wake up too early in the morning or they're unable to return back to sleep. Reduced libido. You know, there's a sharp drop in your sexual desire. And that's a frequently missed key as an indicator of a depressive disorder. Changes in weight, changes in appetite. Concentration loss and memory loss, you know. We've spoken before on menopause and perimenopause. And as a doctor, you've really got to listen to your patient.
I was going to say, it's got to be very
to differentiate between, is this menopause?
Mm.
Is this depression? Is this anxiety? Is this a physical thing, you know? You've got to listen and understand, because some people also can become hyper-pessimistic or indecisive. And these symptoms are overlooked because they mimic other physical health conditions. So I think you said at the beginning, such as thyroid or chronic fatigue syndrome, and they're simply mistaken for the personality changes, the stress in people, and you've got to look for a consistent pattern. You have to look for a consistent pattern of behavior and physical changes over more than 2 or 3 weeks to understand that there's something going on.
So we've been speaking about conditions that many people experience, but then there's more serious mental health disorders that are perhaps misunderstood. And Mark, I see your question, thank you for that, about bipolar disorder. And that's what I want to focus on on at this point, because I think we've seen too many movies where sometimes we hear the word bi and we think it's personalities rather than an actual mental health disorder. So I want to come back to that. Before we do that, though, I just want to round off some. Mark, we will come to your question. I just want to round off this conversation about depression and burnout, and just understand the difference between burnout and depression.
So that's a great question, because burnout is a state of a physical or emotional and mental exhaustion, which is caused by chronic unmanaged stress. So you say, when you were saying earlier, you know, you get the stress and anxiety. If you don't manage it properly, you do burn out. And it's often more related to people who are looking after other people or to working. Whereas depression, as we said, is a chronic mental health condition that is not necessarily tied to a specific situation.
Right.
So they do share symptoms. You know, yes, there's fatigue and lack of motivation. But the burnout is primarily situational, where the depression is often rooted in brain chemistry or genetics, as we said. And it can be combined or confined to one domain with burnout, whereas with depression, it affects all areas of life, such as your hobbies, relationships, and work, whereas burnout would only affect, for instance, work or caregiving.
Right.
So burnout is caused by too much, too many demands, too much stress. Depression can come about even if there's no external cause. And you get a feeling of helplessness, cynicism, frustration. These are all very common with burnout. But depression, you get hopelessness and low self-worth. So you have to decide what you need to do and how to actually treat it. And a lot of time we find people with burnout, when they take a vacation, like in December, they reboot.
Right. So that is it's very different. Jillian says, good program, very sensitively handled. I don't think the sensitivity is on my side, but thank you, Dr. Anton Ryberg. It is 18:39. Send us your questions, 061-895-1019. We'll be back talking about bipolar and other more serious conditions just after this.
Hi FM, your station of choice since 2008.
It is 18:41. Mark says, is bipolar a genuine condition, or do people, because I've heard people think it's nonsense.
So people often mistake what bipolar actually is. Mm. It's a genuine condition. It used to be called manic depression. It's called bipolar now. There's different types, bipolar 1 and bipolar 2. It's a chronic mental health condition, which is characterized by extreme mood swings that you get emotional highs, that's called the bipolar mania, or lows, which is a hypomania with depression. And these type of cycles affect your energy, your activity, your judgment, and they can last days or weeks. And it causes dramatic mood swings, alternating between this high energy and low energy episode. The highs that we found with bipolar, the manic highs, they characterize people who are extremely euphoric. They've got lots of energy, racing thoughts. They don't have any need for sleep. They're extremely impulsive and have a degree of irritability. Whereas depressive episodes with the hypomania, those are marked by profound sadness, hopelessness, loss of interest in activities, and fatigue. So we differentiate the hypo to the hypomania. And we don't actually know the cause, but there is a genetic and brain structure factor that actually contributes to that. It's a lifetime condition, but with effective treatment, including mood stabilizers and psychotherapy, you can definitely treat the symptoms.
So it's absolutely a genuine condition, and let's maybe talk as well, though, about schizophrenia. that is often misunderstood and quite heavily stigmatized. What are the characteristics of this condition?
So schizophrenia is the most misunderstood psychiatric disease in the world. And you watch any movie
Blame
in the world.
Blame Hollywood for that.
Well, that's it. Any movie in the world, and they'll say someone's schizophrenic when they've got an absolute personality disorder, and they're very different.
Okay, fine.
Schizophrenia, to sum it up in one line, is a loss of contact with reality. So it's a severe brain disorder. It's chronic. And there's a distortion in your thinking, your emotions, your perception, and your behavior. And it's typically recognized by this loss of contact with a psychosis, and the symptoms include hallucinations, delusions, and extremely disorganized thinking. So, contrary to popular belief, it's not a split personality disease.
Yeah, where does that come
from? That comes from Hollywood.
And is that such a thing?
The split personality is Dr. Jekyll and Dr. Hyde. That's not schizophrenia. That is a split personality disorder. But schizophrenia is actually a fragmentation of mental processes. You know, these people are seen as psychotic. They can have abnormal behavior, they hallucinate, they have the delusions, they're grossly disorganized. Even people become what we call catatonic. They become completely unresponsive, rigid, and may not move for periods of time. Wow. On the cross to that, you know, people could also present with a loss of motivation, loss of emotion, flat, blunted affect. Their cognitive symptoms are like they get memory loss, they get attention. It's very common, especially in adulthood, from teens upwards to the late 20s or 30s. And it's normally, you get to see signs very early. So it's a slow, gradual change in someone's behavior with social withdrawal, with loss of interest, loss of interest in hygiene, or they have bizarre ideas. It's a lifelong chronic condition. And the problem with schizophrenia is people with schizophrenia often lack awareness of the illness. And it's a big issue that because they don't realize that they don't have any contact with or understanding of the reality. There's a very high rate we find people who abuse cannabis or nicotine even.
I wanted to ask you about that because I've heard it said that cannabis is a trigger. Does that mean that person, well, first of all, is it a trigger or is it something that was there anyway?
So it can trigger it. You know, a lot of times we find we've got latent diseases in the body. Latent disease means a disease that sits there. I've always said that from COVID, we're finding far more asthmatic patients because the COVID triggered that latent gene in the body to cause it. So certain drugs can cause a triggering of a schizophrenic event. And you can find people that get high on drugs and will jump off a building because they start hallucinating and they've got no idea what's going on and they think they can fly. They think they're Superman. So, yes, nicotine, cannabis, vaping, all these things have a much higher increase of suicide and mental disorders.
Have you heard of the word chuffing?
Chuffing.
No.
Yes.
No.
Well, I call it chuffing.
Yes, because they spell it chuffing. Yeah, white people call it chuffing.
Yeah, it's just like migraine, okay? It's spelled the same way, but that's when people, and this is the most ridiculous thing, they take a fire hydrant.
Yes.
And they suck on the fire. These are kids.
Yes.
They suck on the fire hydrant
yes.
to get all the powder from inside there. I mean, it's like...
It's like vaping extreme.
It's not even vaping. This is even worse than vaping because it's not a vapor. You're getting a powder, a toxic powder or toxic sort of liquid powder that comes into your chest, into your nasal passages. It's toxic. I mean, it puts out a fire. Can you imagine what it does inside your body, inside your lungs? It will put your fire out forever.
Yes, exactly.
So don't chuff.
Anyway, it doesn't matter. That's not the focus right now. But how important is early diagnosis of severe psychiatric illnesses?
It ranks there at the top. It's critical. Because it significantly improves long-term prognosis. It enhances treatment responsiveness. Early intervention will help preserve your brain function. It reduces your likelihood of hospitalizations. If I tell you every single call I do when I'm on call at the hospital, we get at least 1 to 2 parasuicides, someone who's tried to commit suicide. Why is this happening? People are depressed. People are anxious. People are not diagnosed with a condition that they've got.
Mm.
But if you do diagnose early, you prevent symptoms escalating, you can get people onto treatment, you reduce the burden and cost globally and nationally of what we can do. And there's even a study that shows this, it causes structural brain protection. So research suggests that treating early can prevent structural brain changes associated with frequent lapses of disease.
That's fascinating. Are these types of conditions, these serious ones, are they genetic, biological, environmental? What's
So I think we even in 2026 we still don't really understand the brain.
Right.
As much as we understand and as much as you know we understand DNA and everything like that, it's generally caused, mental health is caused by, it's a complex situation. It's caused by a combination of genetic, biological and environmental factors rather than just a single cause. So mental illness can run in families. There is a hereditary link and there are a combination of many genes rather than one. So having a relative with a disorder can increase the risk, but does not guarantee that you will develop the risk.
Right.
If you've got biological brain chemistry issues, this things like where your brain structure or function has a chemical imbalance due to your neurotransmitters in your brain. These are the neurotransmitters that regulate your mood and your behavior. If you've got a brain injury or a chronic illness, this can affect you. And as we said, the life experiences, environmental factors, particularly stress, abuse, gender violence, trauma, early childhood neglect, these chronic stresses can trigger onset of mental health issues.
We're going to...
Schizophrenia and bipolar are the most heritable of all these diseases.
Heritable?
Yeah. So in other words, it's much easier.
No, I didn't know if you said irritable. Yeah, exactly. It is 18:49. I'm Howard Feldman. We're going to take some ads and then we'll be back. We'll have 10 minutes left. There are a couple of questions that I wanted to go through with Dr. Anton Meiberg. If you have any questions, now is your time. 061-895-1019.
IFM 101.9 megahertz of life.
It is 18:50, 6:50. I'm Howard Feldman. This is your morning. You're not your morning. It's your weekly checkup. I was doing so well with that. With me in studio, Dr. Anton Meiberg. Let's talk treatments. What are the options that exist for people who are suffering from some form of mental
health? I think because the most important ones for us at this point is depression, anxiety, because they're the more frequent of them all. Then let's talk about those, because those two conditions overlap. So they often co-occur, and then they share biological pathways. So your management often includes things like psychotherapy, medication, and lifestyle changes. And in severe resistant or treatment-resistant cases, you can even look at things like brain stimulation therapies. So on a psychological talk, and to me, this is the most important, is cognitive behavioral therapy, interpersonal psychotherapy, behavioral activation, discussing with a psychologist, mindfulness techniques, exposure therapy, those are all extremely important to identify and challenge your negative thought patterns and behaviors that contribute to anxiety, depression. We can then move on to your medication. I always say to people, don't start with medication. See your psychologist first, see your social worker first, see somebody can help you understand why you've got a problem, and then, if needed, move on to medication. And medication we've got are brilliant at the moment. We've got what we call selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors. And that's generally your first line treatment for your anxiety and depression. And we know these names, Zoloft, Prozac, Cipralex.
Yes,
you get SNRIs, which is venlafaxine. You get your atypical antidepressants, such as Wellbutrin, which is often used for depression as well as anxiety, but more so for depression. Benzodiazepines, which are fast-acting medications. People know Xanax, Valium, Ativan. Beta blockers, which help with the physical symptoms of anxiety, unless you're asthmatic, we don't want you to be on that. And then we've got to look at lifestyle and self-care, regular physical activity, sleep hygiene, dietary adjustments, that type of thing. And lastly, we look at advanced brain stimulation therapies. So there's a thing called transcranial magnetic stimulation, which is an unbelievable non-invasive procedure where they use magnetic fields to stimulate nerve cells in the brain.
Incredible.
It is incredible. There's other things, electroconvulsive therapy, which is effective at rapid-acting treatment for severe debilitating depression. And there's something called esketamine, which is a nose spray, which is used to treat resistant depression. But I think the issue comes is that people misunderstand these medications. So people are scared of them, and as I said, there's a stigma on being on medication. And people think when you take these type of medications, you're going on to happy pills. That's not the case. They aren't happy pills. They work by rebalancing your brain chemistry. So antidepressants don't create an artificial happiness or euphoria. People think, I'm going to take it, I'm going to be so happy. It works by increasing your availability of your neurotransmitters like serotonin and noradrenaline in the brain, which then helps rebalance your brain chemistry and reestablish or restore your normal mood regulation. There's new research that shows that they work on actually neuroplasticity, that the antidepressants help form new connections, which are called synapses, in the brain that are lost during periods of intense stress. And these synapses actually protect your brain from shrinking effects of chronic depression. But people think, once again, I'm going to take an antidepressant today and by tomorrow I'll be fine.
Mm.
And they're not fast acting. They can take 4 to 6 weeks to kick in properly to feel the full therapeutic effects. People have a misconception about them. They think they're addictive. Majority are not addictive. Unlike sedatives or sleep medications, antidepressants don't cause a physical dependency. However, you can't just stop an antidepressant. You've got to wean yourself off it. Otherwise, you have a rebound effect.
Is it a danger that people think, well, I'm taking this. I'm actually fine. I don't need this anymore.
And then they stop it straight
away.
People say, well, it changes your personality. It doesn't. It's there to bring your mood back to its normal state, to help you feel like yourself again, and not to actually change who you are. And there are temporary side effects. We know that. You know, and the side effects generally come within the first few weeks. That can be associated with nausea and dizziness, irritability with sleep and a bit of headaches. And that's why most professionals start on low-dose medication. But once again, this discontinuation syndrome is very, very important, because if you stop them too soon, you will get bad side effects. Another common side effect, which especially men worry about, is sexual dysfunction. But there are multiple medications or adjustments or medications to help with not developing that. And I think combination treatment is the best. Yeah, we're talking about antidepressants often work best when they're combined with psychotherapy, talk therapy, and your lifestyle changes like exercise and a better diet. Not everyone will respond to the same drug.
Right. Okay, so we've really got only a few more minutes, but there's a question that I'm been struggling with, and that is the fact that we're living through a very intense global moment. The war in Israel, the war in Iran, the rise in anti-Semitism in all parts of the world, the stress of knowing that no Jewish community around the world is protected fully from it. These are external stresses. What is the impact that this is having on our mental health, on our anxiety levels, and sense of security, and what do we do about this?
So that's the most pertinent question, because with this ongoing external stress from these global conflicts, from surging anti-Semitism, there's been a profound impact on mental health and anxiety, on people's sense of security, even for people not directly involved in those combat zones. I mean, we get an amplification of 24-hour news cycles and social media. There's something known as war anxiety and global distress. So even people who live in countries far away from the conflict, they actually experience symptoms of PTSD, depression, anxiety. People develop secondary trauma. They get a traumatic response simply by just consuming all these reports of the violence. And how much more so the people who are living in that actual, who are running into bunkers, who are running away from sirens. There's rising anti-Semitism in the world. That causes profound fear and anxiety amongst Jewish communities. There's a lot of background noise of hatred, social tension, and that contributes to what we call an echo chamber of animosity. So it makes people feel insecure, even in previously safe countries. We are overexposed to a barrage of updates, of unfiltered graphic content on social media, which extremely increases your risk of burnout and secondary trauma. And there's so much misinformation and hate speech. So we're seeing a huge psychological impact on people who are living in those countries, as well as people who are living out of them with increased anxiety, depression, fear and insecurity, and a major feeling of helplessness.
And the way to deal with that is to be aware. Because if there is, before we wrap up, and I don't want to leave it on that type of a note, but I guess the question is, if there is a takeaway for tonight, I guess it's that mental health challenges are common, they're treatable, they're nothing to be ashamed of. Anything else that you would add to that? And I guess medication
don't ignore the symptoms.
Yeah.
Sometimes, as we say, what looks like a medical issue could be a mental health problem. People all too often come to me and say, you know, I've been diagnosed with anxiety, and sometimes not even anxiety, it's a physical malady. But anxiety and depression are real. If you hit the nail on the head and you treat them properly, your patients and people can fly.
That is where we leave it. That is where we wrap up. Dr. Anton Meiberg, thank you as always. We were speaking about mental health. Join us next week as 6 o'clock to 7 o'clock. Craig, thank you for keeping us on the straight and narrow. We'll be back with you next week, 6 o'clock to 7 o'clock on Tuesday.